Right now, like as you're listening to this, there are roughly as many bacterial cells in your body as there are human cells,
Yeah, you are literally outnumbered inside your own skin.
which is wild. But before you run to the nearest bottle of hand sanitizer, you really need to know this. If you actually managed to wipe them all out, well, you wouldn't survive the week.
No, you definitely wouldn't.
We have this very simple, almost cartoonish binary in our heads when it comes to bacteria. You know, you touch a dirty doorknob, you get the microscopic villain on your hand, and your job is just to eradicate it.
Right, the whole germs equal bad mentality. It is deeply ingrained, but scientifically, that framework is entirely backwards.
It's backwards.
Completely. The question we should be asking isn't whether bacteria are good or bad. We should really be asking, which specific organism are we dealing with? What's the strain, the dose, the host, and the ecological context? Because a comparatively tiny fraction of bacteria actually causes disease. The rest are doing the hidden, heavy lifting that makes life on Earth possible.
That is exactly what we are getting into today. Welcome to this deep dive into a really fascinating source document. It's called Bacteria, a Systematic Guide, published in August 2026 by the American newspaper.
It's a great read.
It really is. And our mission today is to completely rewire how you think about bacteria. We are moving way past the battlefield metaphor. By the time we wrap up, whether you are prepping for a biology class, a medical meeting, or you just, want to know what's actually happening inside your gut, you are going to see bacteria as the ultimate living infrastructure of our planet.
But to get to that point, we have to start at the foundation, I think.
For sure.
Before we can talk about how bacteria build the world or how they sometimes dismantle our health, we have to establish what a bacterium actually is, fundamentally. And the most common point of confusion is how a bacterium differs from a virus.
I'll admit, I've always kind of lumped them together in my head as just like microscopic things that make me sick. Is a bacterium just a bigger version of a
Not
virus?
at all. They are fundamentally different categories of existence.
Yeah.
Yeah. Viruses are basically just infectious genetic systems. They don't have their own cellular machinery.
Okay.
They're completely dependent on hijacking a host cell to do anything. Bacteria, however, are metabolically active, independent cells. They have their own membranes, genomes, metabolism, and the ability to reproduce all on their own.
Okay, let's unpack this. If we use a tech analogy, a virus is basically just a malicious line of code on a USB drive.
I like that, yeah.
It's harmless until you plug it into a host computer. But a bacterium, that's the entire fully functioning computer itself.
Exactly.
It's got the hardware, the power supply, the software, everything.
That analogy holds up perfectly. And that structural difference is exactly why your doctor won't prescribe antibiotics for the common cold.
Because colds are viral.
Right. Colds are caused by viruses, the USB drives. You can't use a tool designed to dismantle a computer's motherboard to stop a piece of code on a flash drive. It just doesn't work.
So what does this bacterial motherboard actually look like?
Well, we call them prokaryotic cells. Prokaryotic means they lack a membrane-bound nucleus.
So no vault for the DNA.
Exactly. Instead of keeping their DNA locked in a secure vault like human cells do, their DNA is gathered in an open region called the nucleoid.
Which sounds kind of primitive.
It does, but you shouldn't mistake that for being primitive at all.
Yeah.
They have highly selective cell membranes that manage energy generation and transport, and they have incredibly complex ribosomes.
Ribosomes, those are the protein factories, right?
Yep, the protein factories.
Because the source document made a huge deal about the specific size of these factories, noting that bacteria have these 70S ribosomes, which are made of a 30S and a 50S subunit.
Right.
And honestly, reading that, my first thought was just, wait, 30 plus 50 is 80. Why are they calling it 70?
Yeah, it is a classic point of confusion in biology classes everywhere. The S actually stands for Svedberg units.
Svedberg.
Yeah, which is a measure of how fast a particle sinks to the bottom of a test tube in a centrifuge. So it measures size and shape, not just pure weight.
Oh, interesting.
Think of it like aerodynamics. If you have two puzzle pieces, they might weigh a certain amount individually, but when you snap them together, their combined shape makes them move through a fluid differently.
Oh, that makes so much sense. So it's about how they fit together. But why do we care so much about this specific 70S shape? Like, why is that important?
Because human cells use ADS ribosomes.
Oh, I see.
Right. So because the bacterial protein factories are physically shaped differently than ours, pharmaceutical scientists can design antibiotics that specifically seek out and jam the 70S gears.
Without hitting our ADS gears.
Precisely. The drug stops the bacteria from building proteins without harming our human ADS factories. It is the core mechanism of what we call selective toxicity.
So if we can jam up their internal machinery with drugs, what about just attacking the outside, like breaching the castle walls?
Well, to do that, you have to know how the castle is built. And that brings us to the Gram stain.
The famous Gram stain.
Yeah, a technique developed back in the 19th century that we actually still rely on today to categorize bacterial architecture. It stains bacteria either purple, which we call gram-positive, or pink, which is gram-negative.
Okay, let me push back on a rumor I've heard about this, though. People sometimes talk about the kink ones, the gram-negatives, as if they are the ultimate supervillains of the microscopic world.
I've heard that, too.
Does staining pink automatically mean a bacterium is more lethal?
No, that is a massive misconception.
Okay.
The Gram stain is strictly an architectural blueprint. It's not a moral judgment or a measure of lethality. It really just comes down to the cell envelope.
Oh, so?
So gram-positive cells, the purple ones, they have this incredibly thick, spongy outer wall made of a molecule called peptidoglycan.
Peptidoglycan, got it.
When you apply the stain and then dehydrate the cell with alcohol, that thick wall shrinks, and it physically traps the purple dye inside.
And the pink ones just don't have that thick wall to trap the dye?
Correct. Gram-negative cells have a very thin peptidoglycan layer, so the purple washes right out, and they take up a pink counter stain instead.
So why do they get such a bad rap?
Well, what makes gram-negatives notoriously difficult to treat is what sits on top of that thin wall. They have a sneaky outer membrane.
Like a second wall.
Exactly. And embedded in that outer membrane is lipopolysaccharide, or LPS.
LPS.
Yes, and the lipid portion of LPS is a potent endotoxin.
Endotoxin. So if that gets into my system, what actually happens?
If LPS enters your bloodstream, say, when the bacteria are destroyed and break apart, it triggers an intense, chaotic, systemic inflammatory response.
Oh, wow.
We're talking fever, dangerous drops in blood pressure, and potentially life-threatening shock. Furthermore, that outer membrane acts as a physical shield, keeping many large antibiotic molecules out entirely.
That sounds incredibly dangerous. So why shouldn't I consider gram-negatives the main bad guys?
Because gram-positive bacteria, the purple ones, can manufacture and secrete incredibly deadly proteins called exotoxins.
Exotoxins. So they don't even need to break apart.
Right. They don't need to break apart to hurt you. They actively pump out poison while they're alive. The toxins that cause botulism, tetanus, and diphtheria, those are all produced by gram-positive bacteria.
Jeez.
So you absolutely cannot infer how dangerous a bug is just by its color under a microscope.
Okay, so we've mapped out the hardware of a single cell. But a single cell floating around isn't usually what causes problems.
Yeah.
How do they go from a solitary organism to an unstoppable evolving colony?
Well, most bacteria reproduce through binary fission.
Binary fission.
It's a pretty straightforward process. They duplicate their chromosome, they elongate, and then physically split into two identical daughter cells.
Just cloning themselves.
Basically.
Yeah.
If you put a few of these cells in a closed environment with limited food, like a batch culture, they follow a very predictable trajectory.
The growth curve.
Exactly. There's a lag phase where they sense their surroundings, an exponential phase where they multiply wildly, a stationary phase as nutrients deplete, and finally a death phase.
That seems like a pretty standard life cycle. But the text mentions some bacteria basically have a cheat code for the death phase. Endospores.
Yes. Certain genera, specifically Bacillus and Clostridium, possess this extraordinary survival mechanism.
Okay.
When they sense that starvation or extreme environmental stress is imminent, they don't just passively die. They form an endospore.
Now, I hear the word spore and I think of seeds, you know, like a fungus spreading its spores to reproduce. Is that what this is?
It is crucial to separate those concepts. Fungal spores are for reproduction. A bacterial endospore is a biological panic room.
A panic room?
Yeah. One vegetative cell forms exactly one endospore. The bacterium walls off a copy of its DNA and essential proteins, sheds its outer body, and packages itself inside a dehydrated multi-layered armor.
That is insane.
It is. It can sit completely dormant in that state,
right,
surviving boiling water, severe radiation, and chemical disinfectants for decades, maybe even centuries.
Centuries, wow.
And when the environment becomes safe and nutrient-rich again, that one spore germinates back into one active cell.
That is wild. But here's where it gets really interesting for me. It's not just how they hunker down and survive. It's how they share information when they are active. I saw this concept of horizontal gene transfer in the document, and specifically these things called plasmids.
Ah, yes. Plasmids.
I couldn't quite wrap my head around it. Is a plasmid just spare DNA lying around? Like, why would a cell keep extra code?
Plasmids are independently replicating circular DNA molecules that are separate from the main chromosome.
Okay.
To go back to your tech analogy, if the main chromosome is the base code required to run the operating system, a plasmid is an expansion pack.
An expansion pack. Okay, so one cell can literally hand another cell the antibiotic resistance expansion pack or the new deadly toxin expansion pack.
That is precisely what happens, and it's what drives their terrifyingly rapid evolution. They use biological file sharing networks to pass these expansion packs around.
File sharing.
Yes, and there are three main methods. First is transformation, where a cell scavenges free-floating DNA from its environment, often from dead bacteria that have burst open.
So just picking up a fallen enemy's weapon off the battlefield.
That's a great way to put it. Then there is transduction.
Transduction.
Which involves a third party, bacteriophages. These are viruses that specifically hunt and infect bacteria.
Viruses that attack bacteria.
Right. When a phage infects a bacterium, it hijacks the cell to assemble new virus particles. But occasionally the virus makes a packaging error. Instead of packing viral DNA into the new virus head, it accidentally scoops up a piece of the bacterium's DNA.
Wait, so when that flawed virus goes to attack the next bacterium, it isn't injecting a viral infection anymore.
Exactly. It injects the previous bacterium's traits into the new host.
Whoa!
The virus acts as an unwitting courier for bacterial evolution.
That's amazing.
And finally, there is conjugation. This is direct physical file sharing. One bacterium extends an appendage called a pilus, locks onto a neighbor, pulls it close, and actively copies a plasmid over to the recipient.
So they are scavenging code, using viruses as couriers, and physically jacking into each other to share weapons. And they do this while building fortresses, right? The text talked about biofilms.
Yes, biofilms are structured communities embedded in a self-produced sticky matrix of sugars and proteins.
Like slime.
Basically. When bacteria settle onto a surface, whether that's a river rock, a medical catheter, or your teeth, they encase themselves in this matrix. It acts like a physical force field.
So they're protected.
Extremely protected. Bacteria living deep inside a biofilm can be 1,000 times more resistant to antibiotics and disinfectants than free-floating cells.
Now, if I'm thinking about this critically, I have trillions of these highly adaptable, fortress-building, weapon-sharing organisms inside my body right now.
You do.
If they are so capable, why am I not just constantly violently ill?
Because context is everything. Those exact same survival skills are what make them the vital infrastructure of your body, specifically in your gut microbiome.
So they are working for me.
Exactly. They aren't just along for the ride. They are expanding your metabolic capabilities. Your body actually cannot digest certain dietary fibers and resistant starches. The bacteria in your gut ferment those fibers for you.
And what do we get out of that deal?
They convert those fibers into short-chain fatty acids. Those acids are the primary energy source for the cells lining your colon.
Oh, wow.
Without the bacteria, your own intestinal tissue would starve. Furthermore, they provide what we call colonization resistance.
Colonization resistance? Is that like taking up all the parking spaces so the bad guys can't park?
Exactly. The real estate in your gut is intensely competitive. Your normal microbiome consumes the nutrients, occupies the physical attachment sites on your tissues, and even produces compounds that inhibit competitors.
So they fight off the invaders.
A wandering pathogen simply can't gain a foothold because your resident bacteria are fiercely protecting their territory.
So if the microbiome is this protective, well-oiled machine, what flips the switch? Like, how do we go from a happy symbiotic relationship to a life-threatening infection?
That shift into pathogenesis, the ability to cause disease, is not about a bacterium suddenly deciding to be evil.
Right.
It's about a specific strain utilizing tools that, in a certain context, cause severe damage to the host. When a pathogen attacks, it doesn't just float around randomly. It executes a coordinated siege.
Walk me through the siege.
First is adhesion. They throw out microscopic grappling hooks, like pilei or specialized surface proteins, to anchor themselves to your tissue so they aren't washed away.
Step one, anchor down.
Step two, invasion tactics. Once anchored, they deploy enzymes that act like biological battering rams to break down your cellular barriers and push deeper.
Yikes.
Then they use evasion strategies, like building thick capsules around themselves to hide from your white blood cells. And finally, they deploy toxins.
The source highlighted two case studies that show how different this siege can actually look. Let's look at cholera first.
Vibrio cholerae is a masterclass in highly specific pathogenesis. Interestingly, it doesn't invade deep into your tissues.
It doesn't.
No, it stays right in the lumen of your intestine. But once it anchors itself, it releases cholera toxin.
And what does that toxin actually do to the body?
It fundamentally hijacks the cellular signaling pathways in your intestinal cells. It forces those cells to massively pump chloride ions out into the gut, and water rapidly follows the salt.
So you just dehydrate.
The result is profuse, life-threatening diarrhea. The patient can lose liters of fluid in hours.
Which means the immediate treatment isn't to start a war with the bacteria.
The pathophysiology dictates the treatment. If the toxin is causing rapid fluid loss, the life-saving intervention is aggressive fluid and electrolyte replacement.
You just have to outpace it.
You have to keep the patient hydrated while the disease runs its course. Antibiotics can shorten the duration, but hydration saves the life.
Contrast that rapid, violent siege with the second case study, Helicobacter pylori.
H. pylori.
This one completely changed how I think about infections. Usually we think of an infection as a sudden fever, acute pain, you know, a fast crisis.
H. pylori is the ultimate slow burn. It colonizes the incredibly harsh, acidic environment of the stomach.
Which seems impossible.
It does, but it neutralizes the acid immediately around itself, burrows into the stomach lining, and just sits there, causing a low-grade, chronic inflammation. The host might not have a fever or acute symptoms at all.
But over time, it causes peptic ulcers and even stomach cancer.
Exactly. It proves that bacterial disease can be a quiet, decades-long disruption of tissue architecture. It isn't always an immediate emergency.
Which brings us to how we fight back. Once medical science mapped out this hardware and understood the siege tactics, we built weapons. The golden age of antibiotics.
Yes. The mid-20th century development of antibiotics remains one of the greatest leaps in human history. We figured out how to target the specific vulnerabilities we discussed earlier.
Right.
Beta-lactam antibiotics, which include penicillin, are a perfect example.
So how do they work? Do they blow up the cell?
Basically, yeah. They target the cell wall. Remember that peptidoglycan layer we talked about with the Graham stain?
It's a thick purple wall.
Right. The bacteria have to constantly cross-link those molecules to keep the wall strong. Beta-lactams bind to the proteins responsible for that cross-linking. They jam the machinery.
So the wall gets weak.
As the bacterium tries to grow, its wall becomes unstable, and the internal pressure causes the cell to literally burst open.
Wow. And if a drug doesn't go after the wall, it goes after the 70S ribosomes we mentioned, completely halting protein production.
Exactly.
So here's the question that I think terrifies everyone who watches the news. We hear constantly about antibiotic resistance, about superbugs. A lot of people assume, oh, I've taken a lot of antibiotics in my life, so my body is just used to them and they don't work on me anymore.
That is perhaps the most dangerous misunderstanding in public health today.
It is.
Resistance has absolutely nothing to do with your human body getting used to a drug.
Yeah.
Resistance is a property of the bacterial population.
So what is actually happening when a drug stops working?
It is pure accelerated evolution.
Mm.
When you take an antibiotic, you are applying intense evolutionary pressure to a bacterial population.
Right, survival of the fittest.
Exactly. The drug effectively massacres all the susceptible bacteria. But remember those expansion packs, the plasmids, and the random mutations?
The file sharing.
Yes. If just one single bacterium in that population possesses a genetic variant that allows it to survive the drug, that one bacterium suddenly has zero competition for food or space.
Oh, because everything else is dead.
It survives, it multiplies, and very quickly, you have an entire colony of resistant bacteria.
And the mechanical ways they pull off this resistance are frankly astonishing. Like, they don't just passively survive. The source talked about drug destruction.
Yes. Bacteria can deploy active chemical countermeasures. They synthesize enzymes, like beta-lactamases, that literally patrol the cell and physically chop the antibiotic molecule into pieces before it can reach its target.
They just slice it up. Or they change the locks, target modification.
Right. If the antibiotic is a key designed to fit into a specific protein lock in the cell wall, the bacterium will mutate the shape of that lock just enough so the drug bounces right off.
It just changes the shape.
That is the exact mechanism behind MRSA, methicillin-resistant Staphylococcus aureus. It altered a binding protein, rendering entire classes of traditional antibiotics useless.
But the one that really blew my mind was the efflux pumps. Imagine you are in a rowboat that is taking on water and you are bailing it out with a bucket.
Great analogy.
The bacteria literally build microscopic pumps into their cell membranes to bail the antibiotic out as fast as it floods in.
It is an incredible feat of bioengineering, and it is outpacing us. The World Health Organization's 2025 Global Surveillance Report looked at over 23 million confirmed infections.
23 million.
Yes. And their finding was staggering. Roughly 1 in 6 laboratory-confirmed common bacterial infections in 2023 was resistant to antibiotic treatment.
1 in 6. That means the old strategy of just blindly carpet-bombing an infection with broad-spectrum antibiotics is a failing game.
It is no longer viable. We have to shift to precision medicine. We need to know exactly what organism we are fighting and exactly what weapons it possesses before we prescribe a drug.
Which means we need better intelligence, better diagnostics. The source broke down this tension between speed and depth when testing for an infection. Like, PCR tests are everywhere now. They're incredibly fast, right?
They are. PCR and other molecular tests are fantastic for rapidly detecting the specific DNA of a pathogen. However, they have a critical blind spot. They can detect the DNA of a dead bacterium just as easily as a live one. They don't always tell you if the organism is viable or, more importantly, if it is actually susceptible to a specific antibiotic in the real world.
So what's the alternative then?
Classical culturing.
Yeah.
Taking a sample and actively trying to grow the organism in a lab petri dish.
Which takes a while.
It is much slower. It can take days, but it remains indispensable. By growing the viable organism, you can physically test different antibiotics on it and definitively prove what will kill it. Modern diagnostics requires integrating the speed of PCR with the undeniable proof of culturing.
And beyond diagnosing the sick, we have to prevent the spread, which means precision cleaning. The CDC's Spalding framework in the text really clarified this for me.
It's very helpful.
There is basic cleaning, you know, just wiping away dirt. But then there's a crucial line between disinfection and sterilization.
And that line brings us right back to those endospores.
The panic rooms.
Exactly. Disinfection uses chemicals to eliminate most vegetative pathogens on a surface. But standard alcohol or bleach will not reliably kill a dormant bacterial spore.
So they just survive the bleach.
They do. So if you have a critical medical instrument, say a surgical scalpel, that is going to enter sterile human tissue, disinfection is not enough. You require complete sterilization using pressurized steam or radiation to utterly destroy all microbial life, including those armored spores.
Okay, we've spent a lot of time on the arms race, the resistance crisis, the disease part. I want to pivot because the most exciting part of this text is that these microscopic machines aren't just our enemies. If they are this adaptable, this efficient at building proteins and chemical compounds, we can put them to work.
The industrial and biotechnological applications of bacteria are foundational to modern society.
Absolutely.
It starts with ancient technology, using bacterial fermentation to preserve food and create things like cheese, yogurt, and sourdough. But today, we treat them as programmable biochemical factories.
Recombinant DNA technology. We are actually writing the expansion packs now, aren't we?
Exactly. Because bacteria naturally read and share plasmids. Scientists can engineer a plasmid in a lab. We can insert the human gene that codes for insulin into a plasmid, slip that plasmid into a colony of E. coli, and suddenly those bacteria begin manufacturing pure human insulin.
That is just incredible.
We harvest it, and it saves the lives of millions of diabetics. We use the same principles to mass produce industrial enzymes and vaccines.
They can even act as an environmental cleanup crew. Bioremediation. We can deploy specific strains that naturally metabolize crude oil to clean up ocean spills or use them to process wastewater.
And the future is synthetic biology. We are moving beyond just borrowing their natural processes.
Mm-hmm.
Scientists are designing entirely new genetic circuits from scratch, creating living diagnostics, bacteria you swallow that can sense inflammation in your gut and report back, or engineered biomaterials that self-heal.
Which brings us to the ultimate takeaway. The text ends with this integrated model for understanding any bacterial interaction. It states that the outcome of a bacterial encounter equals the organism and strain times the dose times the route of entry times the host's susceptibility times the surrounding microbial community times the environment times the medical intervention.
It is a massive multivariable equation. It permanently retires the idea of a good versus bad binary. The defining challenge of infectious disease moving forward is dual-natured. We must aggressively suppress dangerous pathogenesis and outmaneuver the resistance crisis, but we must do so with enough precision that we preserve and even harness the vital microbial functions that human civilization and natural ecosystems rely upon entirely.
Given that we are now actively programming genetic circuits into these organisms, I want to leave you with a thought to mull over. At what point do we stop thinking of bacteria as wild, dangerous animals we have to fend off and start treating them as a highly advanced, living programming language that we literally share our bodies with? Think about that cartoon villain on the dirty doorknob we started with. Next time you look in the mirror, remember, you're not just a single person fighting a war against germs. You are a walking, talking, highly complex ecosystem. Catch you on the next deep dive.